Welcome to Community Conversations with the Louisville Pride Foundation. Today we are talking with Zion Brooks, Louisville Pride board member and longtime activist in anti-racism and police abuse. Last time we talked with Kentucky State Representative Attica Scott. We've been rearranging our schedule a little bit to focus on issues around police, racism, and elevating LGBTQ people of color's voices. I want to thank our sponsors that make Digital Pride possible: Republic Bank, Norton Healthcare, Connolly Law Offices, Caperton Realty, Evo Mortgage, The Fairness Campaign, the ACLU, and Heine Brothers Coffee. Today, I am joined with one of our Louisville Pride board members, Zion Brooks, who also works at the University of Louisville in the Office of Diversity and Inclusion on the Health Sciences campus. I might have gotten a little bit of that wrong. And you are in school as well, studying, getting your nursing degree, or is that your fiance?
No, so my fiance is doing a PhD in Pan-African Studies, and I'm taking about like two prerequisite classes before I can enroll in the accelerated nursing program.
Okay, so I wasn't totally wrong there. I had it off. So we've been talking about everything that's been going on and talking about how, as an organization, you know, we struggle with what to do. Other organizations, other individuals struggle with what to do. And you can choose a strategy because it feels good. You can choose a strategy because it looks good. And you can choose a strategy because it does good. And ideally it does all three, but you know, I think there's a lot of times when we do things because they feel good or they look good, and they may not really be productive. My biggest worry is that we're going to go back to normal, you know, whatever we can put big quotes around that, but that all of this will happen. People will be outraged, but then somehow this time next year, nothing will have really changed.
Yeah. So I first feel compelled to say that what I say right now are my thoughts and not connected to my role at the HSC Office of Diversity and Inclusion. That said, they know who they hired.
You're also not necessarily speaking for Louisville Pride, but we also know
not either, but also,
who we put on our board.
Yeah, but the executive director knows who I am as well.
Yes. if we both agree on it, it doesn't necessarily mean it's LPF policy.
Yeah. When I, you know, talk to people who, you know, have like the same fears that things will, you know, go back to the same. And I think that like is a valid fear, because ultimately, like, that's what this country has done. You know, like, things happen, people have really short attention spans, go back to normal, things happen again. So we've always been, you know, very reactive. But I think in this particular situation, and to be clear, like, I am a total pessimist. Like, I'm a self-identified pessimist, and prefer to operate in the place that we live in now rather than like what we're building. So for me to say this is a lot. but basically, I think in this particular situation that there is no choice but to change. You know, when I think about it, I'm like, okay, well, option one is that, you know, civic leaders are like, okay, look, all right, you got us, and we need to implement change, and we're going to work diligently on, you know, creating and implementing policies that, you know, meet whatever requests and demands people are making. Or they don't, and they continue to do what they're doing, and these cities are going to burn to the ground. And they're gonna have to spend a lot of money to repair them if there is anything left to repair. So either way, there will be the change of renewal and, you know, kind of like rebuilding, or the change of vastly improving what we have now. But either way, like, one of those things, like, it's not like this right now is not an option. Like, it's just, and that's not just my opinion. Like, this cannot continue, it will not continue. One of those things will happen.
I do. I think I tend to agree with you. I tend to agree with you that we're getting some feedback. I think we're at a point where it's at the breaking point. like, you know, the system can't take anymore. And, you know, our national leadership is so unwilling to compromise that it's going right to the extreme. There's no, you know, there's no co-opting. There's not going to be a solution that's going to come down from the federal government that'll be good enough to sort of pacify people, which you might get in a different administration.
Yes, but I mean, yeah, I definitely agree with that. Total trash from top to bottom. But I think that there's something, and I'm not patting any of these people on the back, but to acknowledge that there is something different than when these things have happened prior. So I hate to even utter his name, but Mitch McConnell made that statement that was like, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, some of these police are starting to look like pretty guilty. Now, for him to say that, like what? And then you've got Pat Robertson, who was like, you're out of pocket. Like this is crazy. And then you've got, you know, George W. Bush, who just endorsed Biden. And so I'm just like, what part of the upside down are we in right now? But I think that, you know, I've always said that in order for people who support the current administration, if they were to say, okay, this is enough, then that means, whether they say it or not, like that means I voted for this person based on our shared hate and racism, and I made a mistake. Now, they're not going to say that out loud, but I think that once people withdraw, so like Mitch McConnell, Pat Robertson, George W. Bush, if people start saying like, I didn't sign up for this, they're like, you know, maybe they like the good old fashioned racism that we're used to. Like, you know, maybe, I don't know, but once these leaders that normally have been supportive of this person start to say, this is enough, there's only so far that he can go. I mean, we have checks and balances. And, you know, I was talking to my brother earlier and he was like, yeah, dude, I think they're getting ready to put dude in timeout and just sit him down. Because I think folks are just like, you're doing too much. And like, you don't speak for me and you need to sit down.
Yeah, I mean, when they start talking about sending in the army, are you hearing that feedback?
No. I will say this. We have some gentlemen that are working on our house. This has been going on for months, so I don't know if you can edit that out.
I might just have to edit out the part. I don't know. It's like, it only happens when I first start speaking, so I don't know what the issue is.
Does it sound like chatter?
No, it sounds like I can hear me, like an echo. No,
I can hear that. And then it's not the dude. Sorry that I blamed them.
We'll try that. We'll edit this down somehow or other. I can't even remember where I was going with that. I mean, you said, you know, there's racism has been a part of America for as long as America's been here.
And it will continue to be so.
And it's, and prejudice and discrimination will exist in any human society, probably. I mean, unless we're, you know, it's difficult to imagine some situation in where that is eliminated, you know.
Well, everybody's prejudiced. Like, I'm prejudiced. I have a lot of, everybody is, and it's not a good or a bad thing. It's a matter of, like, what do you do with it? Like, what are you doing, you know, not even to reconcile that, but to acknowledge it in yourself. But yeah, everybody's prejudiced.
And it's part of a big part of it is being aware of it. I mean, I think for white people who want to be allies, it's not that you're not racist. It's that you understand that you have racism in you because you're an American. You're born and raised in a society where racism is so prevalent. It's in all the media. You know, you cannot not be racist if you're a white person raised in the United States.
Yeah, and so, like, that is definitely true, and I work, we do education and trainings with a lot of people who definitely have a problem with that, because nobody wants to hear that they're racist. You know, that's just a sore spot. But I do want to talk about the word ally, which I actually don't use, for a couple of reasons. You know, if you think about allyship, like I think about, let's say, war. And so if a country is an ally to another country, they could be called in for action, or they can do nothing and just exist as an ally on paper. So I prefer to use the words like accomplice or co-conspirator, because those are two roles wherein, you know, folks have the same, they take on the same risk as you or whoever they're supporting. They take on the same risk and have the same fears. So those are the words that I choose. And like, I feel like, you know, as marginalized folks, I don't think we have to say like so-and-so is a co-conspirator, so-and-so is my accomplice. It's just implied versus the word ally, which people usually label themselves as.
It's very performative. It's very performative. And I tend to, you know, one of my basic principles is that character is shown through deeds and not words. So if I have to tell you if I'm an ally, if I have to tell you I'm an anti-racist, if I have to tell you all these things, then I haven't done it. Right. You know, either I'm doing it and you're seeing it and you know it, or I'm not doing it. And then me telling you I'm doing it even just makes it worse, because it's clearly I'm not doing these things and yet I'm claiming it. So that's, you know, I tend to avoid some of these words too when I talk about these issues, because I'm trying not to do the self-congratulatory, you know, as a white person who's committed to blah, 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 right. I've done all of these things.
Yeah.
You know, I just say, here's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, have a point with that.
Yeah, but like, I feel like you're kind of like in a different situation, because like, you're like the ED of an organization. It's like, you literally have to report what you're doing.
Yeah, but I also don't let that hold me back on my personal, I also speak out personally. But that's one of the things, I mean, I've, you know, that's an approach that I've tried to bring to Louisville Pride as well, is that we are going to show you what we're doing. We're not going to tell you what we're doing. Now, there does come to be a point where it's like, okay, we need to, like, sometimes words are action, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes a statement is needed or something like that. But, so, I mean, is it worthwhile to talk about what white people can do in times like this? Or if they haven't figured it out by now, are they going to be able to?
Right. So for me, it's not worthwhile to talk about what white people can do, because that's not my job. You know, I feel like, you know, white people collectively have created this problem. It is on them to solve it. So, you know, it's the responsibility of other white people to gather those white people and have that conversation, and recognize that that's probably not going to always be a good conversation. It's going to be a shitty conversation. And like, that's fine. You know, I think that, you know, I don't know how Thanksgiving or Christmas is going to look this year, but I know like in previous holidays, you know, folks have said, yeah, like to white people, like, no, like if you're going to go home, then you go home to educate those people that you know are problematic. Don't you dare say, it's just too stressful, I can't. You fucking go home and you educate those people.
Because they're the ones who can reach those people.
Yeah. Yeah, and it might take like years. Like, I don't know, you go home every year. If you go home every 2 years, Like, if, and it doesn't matter. Like, yes, people are going to be uncomfortable. So it's like, if you go to your meemaw's birthday, it's like, yeah, girl, like, I am so happy that you're 102. But you're racist. What you just said was racist, or what you just said was inappropriate. Will that really, like, bring down the party? Yeah. But so be it. With discomfort comes learning.
I think sometimes there's also the possibility of, you know, planting some seeds with these people if, you know, you have a relationship with that, like, you don't, you know, I think there's this, people want to cut people out of their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to talk to my meemaw because she's racist.
Right.
And it's like, you know, you don't have to tell, you don't have to yell in her face and cuss at her, but push, you know, call it out, redirect it, you know, and maybe you get a baby step. I mean, you're not going to take somebody from a place of overt racism to being a co-conspirator,
right?
Overnight.
Yeah, like, if they can just, like, check their privilege, yeah, like, definitely read the room. But I will say this, like, I think that this is something that, you know, LGBTQ folks do all the time when they, you know, come out or otherwise, you know, are more comfortable with letting folks know their personal information, which is, you know, we generally prepare ourselves to be let down. And I know for me, you know, like, I prepared myself to have to cut off my family. So as a personal story, because sometimes that is the option. So, you know, regardless of how much, you know, I appreciate what my family has done and raising me and all that stuff, I don't talk to my mom's brothers and sisters. And I didn't just ghost them. Because if you ghost, then you're not clear about the actions and the behaviors that gave the consequence of you ghosting. So you don't have to say it to them out loud, but consider writing a letter. And that's what I did. Like, I wrote a letter. It was short and to the point, and it was like, bam, bam, bam. In conclusion, because of your behaviors and your choices, we will not be speaking anymore. And, you know, like, again, like, that's sometimes what you have to do. Now, later on, you know, is there the possibility of reconnecting? For some people, yes. And it just depends on what kind of person you are. For me, no. But if you are the kind of person that is open to reconnecting with them, like, after taking a break, which people need breaks, then okay, like, reconnect with them and see where they're at. Because sometimes, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And I also think that it, you know, like, improves people's ability to think and to reflect.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about, well, I had two things. That one, I want to talk a little bit about LGBTQ people of color, but also just thinking about, you know, how about these tough conversations with people. I think, you know, racism, sexism are so entwined in America and our culture that they become part of somebody's identity. You know, if you're proud to be an American and you're proud of our history, and someone gives you a narrative that directly challenges virtually all of that history, that's something that is fundamentally challenging to your identity as a person. And I think sometimes we're very glib about that, like, oh, get over it. But, like, you know, if you're stripping away a part of somebody's ego, even if it's a toxic part that needs to come away, that's difficult. That's, you know, that's a painful thing. And I think, and it's the same thing for people coming out, you know, LGBT people with their families. If you're in a family that has a faith tradition that is anti-LGBT, and that's a big part of who you are, that doesn't just, you know, that's not something that falls off overnight.
Yeah.
That's something that has to be, I mean, that's a painful process.
Yeah, it's like a total, like, existential crisis, you know? So, like, you know, adding to, you know, that it's the responsibility of other white folks to gather other white people. And I don't, I mean, honestly, I'm just, like, talking about white people. Like, I don't know what y'all do. Like, I don't know what y'all do. I don't know what you talk about at your monthly meetings. Like, I have no clue. But, you know, like, in addition to
stock prices,
right,
sports scores,
baseball, apple pie. Right.
We trade apple pie recipes.
Right. So in addition to, you know, like, gathering those folks and, you know, educating them, I don't know, maybe for you is, like, are you also willing to kind of, like, Sherpa them through their feelings? Or, I don't know, maybe you direct them to a mental health professional. I always forget her name, but she's my boo. Jane Elliott, my boo. So the reason why I bring her in is because, among other things, like, she says that racism is a mental health issue.
I've often thought of it as being like addiction.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it's like you have to talk through it. You know, the way to get over addiction is to talk with other people who've gotten over addiction.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only way to get through racism is to have some really painful, awkward, uncomfortable conversations with
Mike. I think you, like, seriously, like, can you imagine if racists that are interested in reforming follow the 12 steps?
Right.
Right. Because, like, I feel like when I think about, and I don't know all of them by heart, but, like, the 12 steps, like, all of the things that you do should also be the things that you do as a recovering racist.
It's pretty close to it. And it's, you know, I mean, and, you know, one of the core parts of the 12 steps is taking a fearless moral inventory. You know, right. You talk about a soul stripping process to kind of come to terms with who you really are and not who you just think you are, you know, and that's, I mean, and that's, I think, what's missing from so many of these conversations is that people in, you know, I think there's a lot of white people that want to prove that they're allies by yelling at racists, yelling at other white people. And that's, there's a place for yelling, but that's not what changes people.
No.
You know, what changes people is convincing them that you are somebody they can trust to have these conversations, you know, to share their feelings, and you'll help them work through those and not just, you know, denounce them.
Yeah, because, like, you can't just open that can of worms, which is why I suggest, you know, writing a letter, whether or not you send that letter or whether or not, like, that's just a letter to kind of gather your own thoughts. But, like, yeah, you don't just, like, pop open that can of worms, be like, sucks to be you, bro, in those types of situations. Like, you know, I've definitely had to write some hard letters to, actually, they weren't hard. They were easy for me, but
some, hard to read.
Right. Some letters that were definitely hard to read, fun for me to write. But even though, you know, like, I started with being like, yeah, here are the issues. Here's what you've done. This is unacceptable. Yada, yada, yada. And here are some resources that can help you work through that. You know, I didn't want to just, like, open up this Pandora's box and then just be like, all right, you fix it. Because if they could have fixed it, you wouldn't be having that conversation.
Well, and that's
resources.
And they need those resources because it's one of this is a really complicated, vicious circle problem, because we put the emotional labor on people of color and LGBT people and LGBT people of color to heal us, to help us be accepting of you.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of freaking work, and it's all work that you do and not me or, you know, whoever we're talking about.
Yeah. Before I respond to that, I do want to say, I truly think that we are on something with 12 steps and recovering racism. We should work on that. And I also want to say, people, y'all heard it here first. Don't be mean and try to take our idea.
No, hey, that's the 12 steps are given freely, right?
You're really, but as far as like how we're going to use it with racism, don't perpetrate. So like, what did you say? You were like,
well, actually, you know, I had this idea a long time ago and I pitched it to Ann Braden and she's like, I don't know, I'm wary of these white people only anti-racist groups.
Yeah.
And that kind of, that put it on the back burner.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, that's a valid concern, like to be worried about that. And I mean, like, I think those spaces are necessary because, like you said, it's like, I personally, like, stopped doing that a while ago. I used to do, like, a lot of, like, LGBT 101 talks and yada, yada, yada. I won't do it. Even in the context of my job, I've made it very clear, like, no, I will not be on your panel. No, like, I'm not gonna, like, there's a lot of things that I just don't do because I'm like, yeah, that's like, that falls within the scope of my work, but that like falls outside of the scope of like what I do, like as a human being. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I think there should be those spaces so that, you know, that those kind of conversations can happen. You know, also too, like, I will say this. Ooh. Mimosa. I didn't know what was in here. I was like, this is orange. So I just finished this doula training. And so it was me and 10 other people. I was the only masculine and center person in the group. There were other, you know, Black folks and people of color, but there were also white women. And, you know, as we know, like the area of doing doula work is incredibly white, which is interesting because it's rooted in like Blackness.
You're assuming a lot more knowledge on my part about the history of doula work than already exists.
Primarily white these days. Same thing with midwifery. And both of those things are rooted in Black culture. Sons, you know, certification or whatever, like people just did it. Slaves did it. So in this group, I think it was on a Saturday, we did 3-day training Saturday. This one woman was like, and let me just be clear, like I'm going to paint the picture. White, she had dreadlocks, they were wrapped up. And so, you know, this is where like, you know, she was just like, you know, I just want to like acknowledge. I started telling my friend that she like started cracking up laughing because she knew what was coming. She was
like, I see you.
Right. She was like, I just want to acknowledge you. Like, what's going on and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, just say that like, you know, I support whoop de whoop and whatever. And then she was like, sorry, I'm a crier. And I was like, no surprise. But then this other woman was like, you know, I'm so glad that you said something. Other white woman, I'm so glad you said something. You know, me too. A bunch of stuff that I don't remember. And I'm also a crier. But our facilitator, like our teacher, who I would say, I don't know if she identifies as such, but she definitely acted as an anti-racist in that moment. And, you know, she was like, and they were just like, you know, what can we do? Yada, yada. So she was like, okay, so like, first, don't you dare ask people of color what you can do to help. And there are tons of resources that are going around right now, specifically about what white people can do to help. I will post them in the chat box. And then she moved on, you know, so I think it's like, in those situations, like, you know, that's necessary. And you can do that. And I think, you know, like whatever these all white education spaces look like, you know, should be led by like a strong white person who has been doing like anti-racist work, you know, for a while and is comfortable in it. So that when these, and these are tactics, I feel like, you know, like the tears and whatever, like I've seen like so many white women cry when they're told that they're racist, when they're trying to say like, I support you. I mean, I don't know, just like so many tears. But like in those moments when that white person can be like, shut it down. Like, we're gonna talk about this, but also like, I'm not gonna acknowledge your tears. Like, I'm not gonna acknowledge these like feigned emotions or whatever. Yeah, just like shut it down and like keep it moving.
The last couple of days, I've encountered African-Americans, like I was walking my dogs and the mail carrier came by and I went to get some food and the lady that brought it out is a person of color, just like, you know, totally like 2 second interactions. And I, you know, in my mind, I'm like, how can I tell this person that I support right. them? And, you know, and the answer is be friendly and wave and say hi and good afternoon. And like,
yeah. Things that you do as like a well-developed human being.
Right. Like wave, you know, they know what's going on. Like yeah. they'll, you know, I don't have to give a monologue.
Right.
Or make it about me or write a letter or, yeah. you know.
Well, I'll tell you a secret. And I'm pretty sure I'm allowed to tell the secret. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I'll get in trouble at the next like monthly meeting of Black folks. But, you know, we know. Like, we know whether or not, and y'all ain't even gotta open your mouth. Like, we know whether or not a person, a white person, is racist or otherwise problematic within seconds. It's actually way better than my gaydar, and it's definitely more fine-tuned than my transdar. Like, because I've been dealing with, you know, well, I don't know what kind of dar that is, but I've been dealing with it for a while. I've been practicing.
It's a multi-dimensional dar.
Yeah, I've been like practicing and honing that skill for a very long time. So like, yeah, like it's kind of like in those moments, you know, yeah, if you're just like, and I'm not in any way like, you know, encouraging color blindness because I don't believe in that. But if in these moments.
But it does exist. There yeah. are people who cannot tell red from blue, well, or green.
Right. No, I'm talking about the people that are like racist and say they're colorblind. And I'm just like, but how do you get dressed though? Like, right. You put together your outfits. Are you wearing mismatched socks? Like, what do you do? But, you know, if you are in these situations, just being a decent human being, then we're probably not going to think much of it. But what you don't want is us thinking you're fucking racist. Like, we have a guy across the street, the Lichfield Street, and I don't know this man. I don't know him. But I call him the racist across the street. And I base that on a lot of things, like visual observations, mostly. And also, my spirit is telling me that's a racist across the street. Now, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how, like, active he is in his racism. Like, I don't know. But I definitely feel that, like, that is a belief, or that he holds some beliefs that I would disagree with regards to race. Like, that is certain.
Yeah, I had something I was going to say, and I lost it there. And in all of that immense amount of wisdom, once you get the mimosa in you. No, oh, you know, I remember there was a comedian I work with doing some improv, and he was making a joke with a patron in the audience who was very old, and he said later, he's like, he knows he's old, you know, and so, and it was very much like a, you know, laughing along with you, you know, sort of joke. Yeah. And I always think about that from now on. I'm like, you know, you don't have to, like, we get so awkward around people.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, you know, as you say, like, people know what's going on. Like, yeah. We don't have to communicate it to them and no. then tell us, I don't need to tell you what's going on in the world and then tell you how I feel about it. And then, you know, like, you know, I can just be a freaking human being.
Yeah.
Well, what else do we need to cover? We haven't even gotten to the world's problems and solving them yet.
I don't know.
But for LGBT people of color, Can we talk about that a little bit, or is that a big freaking can of worms that we should wait another day? Or,
well, it depends on how deep you want to go. And I would say, I'm just going to speak for myself, because I don't represent anybody else but myself. I represent my dog, but we're on the same page. So, I mean, for me, being a queer person of color and a trans person of color, you know, I often say, and I'm not like, I don't play like the oppression Olympics with my identities, but, you know, being Black is my most salient identity. Like, that is unmistakable. So I have long since said that my biggest worry, like my, you know, as far as like being a society goes, and this is like not really like, I'm not saying that this is like I'm scared, because I'm generally not scared of much, but like I think like any other normal person would have fear about this. But, you know, like I'm never like worried about, you know, being attacked or yelled at because I'm queer or trans. Hell, half the time most people don't even know that. But what they do know is that I'm Black. And honestly, it's also interesting in that, you know, like I've navigated, you know, spaces as, you know, navigated those spaces as, you know, never like a female identified person, but have navigated those spaces like in a more, you know, female body or traditionally female body, I don't know. And then have navigated the spaces as I live now. And this, again, this is for me. There was a time, and I think that most trans men of color will be able to tell you about their time. Like, there is a moment where you're like, shit is different. Like, shit is different. Like, I did like crazy things like as a youth, like especially like here in the city of Louisville. Like, I was in anti-racist action. Like, I was a member of BRAT, you know, went to Klan rallies, went to police brutality rallies, even though I wasn't supposed to go. You know, so like I've done those things. I've encountered law enforcement before. That said, I never really, at the time, feared for my life. Now, that could be because of a different time. It could be because I was a youth. I don't know. But I do know that I look younger than I am. So that plays into it.
Because you're like 60.
And like when I lived in North Carolina, that was my moment. You know, like me and a friend were being goofy. We walked up the street, and my friend was Mexican. And we walked up the street to a paleta store. And I just moved there. I've been looking for an office chair for my desk. And we get to the paleta store, and look, lo and behold, the business, like the key shop next door, had this office chair out there just for free. And I was just like, okay, it doesn't smell like pee. I'm gonna take this home. And so we start to go home with our paletas, and I noticed that on the street that we're on, I'm like, dude, this is an incline. And me and this friend were always like up to some fuckery. So I hop on the chair, and I'm like going down this hill, spinning around, having like a great time. And I get to the bottom, and alongside me is an unmarked police car with a man in there who had the reddest fucking face I had ever seen. And so I stopped and I got off. And the interaction that happened after that is like one of the only times in my life that I was like actually, well, one of the two times in my life that I was actually fearful for my life. He was not, I'm not going to belabor the point. He was not fucking nice. He didn't put hands on me, but I recognized that situation could have been totally different, you know, especially because like I'm me, you know, I was raised that I could say anything that I wanted to say so long as I say it respectfully, and I did. I also, you know, advocate for myself and, you know, had to make it very clear. Like, I was like, yeah, you caught me. I was being ridiculous, you know? But ultimately had to get to the point where I just had to like put some more bass in my voice and be like, excuse me, I am grown. I pay taxes. I do not appreciate the way that you're talking to me right now. So I let him finish his shit. And then I was like, I need your name and your badge number. And I got that. And like, before I got home, I was on my phone calling the number to report him. And to my surprise, I got a call back. And they asked me like, well, what would you like to see done? And I was just like, I don't know. I would like for this motherfucker to not murder somebody someday. Like, you know, so like do whatever it is you need to do to ensure that he doesn't murder someone someday. Cause like he's wound really fucking tight. And like, when I think about, that, like, that's my moment. Like, that is when I was like, okay, I am a Black man in these United States of America. And I'm not saying by any means that Black women do not have the same struggles. This is just, these are just my experience.
There's one thing in reaction to that is that's one of the really key reasons why a civilian review board is important, which is one of the things people have been talking about and which allegedly is going to come out of this in Louisville.
We've been talking about that for a very long time.
Yes, yes.
Since I was like 16 or 17.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's been the key demand, and that it would have subpoena power, but that it would be able to, to investigate that kind of incident, see that kind of pattern with an officer like that, you know, and prevent somebody from getting murdered, because that's what, you know, there's 20 of those incidents where nobody does get hurt, at least doesn't get physically hurt, that will create a pattern can be seen that can be dealt with theoretically. But that story kind of blows me away, because I'd never thought about that part of a transition for a person of color who's transgender to go from walking through the world as being perceived as female to being perceived as male, and the downside of that, the trade-off of that would be inherent in that.
Yeah, I'm trying to honestly, like, I'm like, you said trade-off, I'm like, I'm trying to figure out what the come up was. Because, like, seriously, like, I'm virtually hairless. Like, I mean, did my voice drop? A little bit, but, like, you hear me talking now.
I guess I mean...
Faster, and I put on muscle faster. But, like, I'm like, but really, though, like, what was, like, the come up?
I guess, I mean, just as you were saying, like, it's not that being a Black man or a Black woman is easier or harder than right. one or the other. It's, you know, so that, but that's something that I, you know, my experience of course has been so different. So it's like that, it's interesting how these things like that, that just so basic. And that's something, as you say, every trans man of color has had that experience.
I would be surprised if even one of them didn't.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And yeah, that's, yeah. Wow. That just kind of blew me away.
And I think the same thing. And again, this is just me speculating because I don't know their experience, but I do also think that the inverse is true, you know, because there are a whole set, like, I am not envious. I am not envious at all for my, you know, cis female friends, or for my, you know, trans feminine or more feminine of center friends. And I guess here's the come up. I am generally not fearful of other people walking down the street. Mm-hmm. I'm fearful of police, but not other folks, because I know that they're going to cross the street for me. You know, if I go on a date, I don't have to worry about having to fend off unwanted advances. And I'm not saying that that's true for all trans men. Again, this is just for me. You know, these are things that I don't have to worry about. I will walk around at night anytime and not really think, again, except about the police. But I'm not thinking about, like, anybody running up on me, trying to grab me and put me in a van or, you know, anything like that. Like, that's not a worry for me.
I'm running out of questions to ask, and I think we've covered a lot. So I'm gonna go ahead and stop recording now.
Sounds good.
Thank you for joining us for Community Conversations today, and we'll be back on Tuesday with more conversation.